Hello, I'm John Neff, Global Editor-in-Chief of MotorOne.com, and welcome to this week's episode of the MotorOne.com podcast. By the end of 2019, no fewer than 25 vehicles on sale today will be discontinued. That's a lot, and while some of them will miss, for the most of them, well, they deserve the axe. On today's episode, we're going through the list of dead cars walking with an eye towards which cars we'd save and which cars we'd recommend take their place. Joining me again this week is MotorOne.com senior editor and possible future owner of a Dodge Dakota Shelby Edition truck I really want him to buy, Jeff Perez. How you doing, Jeff?
Good, John. How are you?
Very good. Also with us is writer and my fellow Ohioan, Chris Bruce. How you doing, Chris?
Doing well. Glad to be back.
Awesome. So today, our episode today is inspired by an article we did that we do every year about the cars being killed. And this one started out as the 10 cars being killed this year. And we add to it like every 2 weeks, there's a couple more cars announced that are being killed off. Right now, the number is at 25 vehicles being killed for by the end of 2019. That number may be 26 by the end of this podcast. We're actually trying to find out. So it's a pretty big list, but this happens every year. This is part of the churn of the whole fleet of vehicles on sale in the U.S. So what we want to do today is go through that list, those 25 cars, and let you know each and every one that will be going away. After we're done with that, since this list is a little controversial among our group, we want to play a little game where we pick the cars that we would save off the list, that we would prevent from dying. However, in order to do that, a sacrifice must be made. So for every car we choose to save, we're going to pick a car that's currently on sale that we think should replace it on the list. So it's kind of like the Soul Stone situation in Avengers where, you know, in order to get what you want, you got to sacrifice something you love. So, all right. So you guys want to get into this?
Absolutely. Let's go.
Let's do it.
All right. So let's start going through the list. I'm going to start with the number one on our list, which is the Alfa Romeo 4C Coupe. That one's pretty sad. I don't think anyone wishes it would go. But
it's pretty mediocre as far as what it is.
Well, the open top version is staying for a year. Yeah. So it's not gone entirely. So we don't have to cry. Second one is Cadillac ATS sedan, and of course this is being replaced by the CT4. So I don't know if we can call it like it's being killed. Yes, but it's being replaced by something that is similar. I think it'll be a little larger, but. Next one, the Chevy City Express. So this is a commercial vehicle, basically Chevy's panel van that is really a Nissan panel van. Chevy just takes them and puts a Chevy badge on the front. Next one is the Chevy Cruze, which is their compact car. Next one, Chevy Equinox Diesel. So this is just the diesel version of the Equinox. Equinox is staying in general, but the version with the diesel engine, which I think was only around for a year or two.
I'd love to know how many of those they sold. It has to be ridiculously small.
Yeah, it's going to be a rare gem on the used market for sure. The next one going away is the Chevy Volt, which, you know, was a very significant vehicle when it launched. It had two generations. And I would argue is always a really good idea that was executed pretty well. It had some good years, but lately it has fallen on hard times with all the battery electric vehicles that are going on sale now. So another great used market pickup, though, because their resale value is really low. Next is the Ford C-Max Hybrid and the C-Max Energy, which is the plug-in hybrid version. This one I'm less sad to see go than the similar Chevy Volt.
Definitely.
Never really found fans. Next up is the Ford Fiesta, which is, you know, the beginning of Ford's axing of all of their cars. And it goes along with the Ford Focus as well as on this list. So both small, both of Ford's smallest cars are on the axe list. As well as their sedan, the Ford Fusion. But the only Fusion going away for 2019 is the Fusion Sport, but the Fusion itself will still be around for at least another year, I think.
Yeah, I think
kind
that's
of
the
as
case.
A dead car walking. I mean, it's going to go. It's just, it kind of gets a brief reprieve, but yeah, that's the way we understand it.
Exactly. And the last car on Ford's slate of vehicles is the Taurus, and that's, of course, a storied nameplate, but its last year will be 2019. Still in the Ford camp, we move on to Lincoln with the MKT, the really weird long three-row wagon thing that is the brother to the Ford Flex, even though the Ford Flex is not dying this year, but I can't imagine it'll be around for much longer either. Lincoln is also getting rid of the MKX, although that's really the death of a name, because it's being replaced by the Nautilus. So it's more just the death of an alphanumeric name. Also dying, Mercedes AMG SL63. Definitely sad to see that go.
That's just the range topper. You know, the regular SL, it doesn't have a lot of time left, but you can still get a V8 SL.
Right. So they're kind of just killing off the trims one by one.
Yeah.
Next up, the Nissan 370Z Roadster. The ancient 370Z lives on in coupe form, but they're killing the soft top. Also the Nissan Juke, the funny looking little subcompact crossover, the Smart 4.2, that experiment in the US has ended after two generations. Tesla is even killing a vehicle. Actually it's more a trim. The, long range rear wheel drive version of the Tesla Model 3, the longest range Tesla Model 3 you could get, it could go up to 325 miles on a charge, which is a little bit longer. A little bit farther than the all-wheel drive long-range Model 3 can do. Also leaving us is the Toyota Corolla iM, which is a four-door hatchback. And next up, the Toyota Yaris IA, which is a very unsung little car. It's built on Mazda underpinnings and is a really great handling and really affordable kind of subcompact sedan. Definitely should be good on the used market. I would buy my kid that in a heartbeat if I had a kid, which I don't. Next up is an iconic one, Volkswagen Beetle. This is the second generation of the modern Beetle, and this is where that run ends, and really this is where the run of the entire Beetle production going back a very long time ends, because the Beetle won't be produced anywhere else like it was. Kind of the old original Beetle was produced in some South American countries for a really long time, but that's it for the Beetle. Also in the US, at least, the Volkswagen Golf. You know, this hasn't been confirmed officially, but we do have it on good word that the five-door Golf will not stick around. The GTI and the Golf R will for the next generation, but it seems crazy that we're not getting this car that is like a perennial bestseller in Europe.
And actually, we just found out today we will not get a Golf R for next year.
So we'll have to wait until the eighth generation car to get the Golf R back.
Correct.
Also, this is kind of surprising just because it's an SUV. The Volkswagen Touareg will be leaving us. You know, Volkswagen has the Atlas now, which is kind of doing the duty. And the Touareg was always kind of a premium offering. So I think that's probably why it never had huge sales, is because it was just so expensive. Also on the list, and these actually aren't even in our article yet. We're going to be updating the article before this podcast goes live. But you mentioned the Golf R. There's also the TT. And is it a version of the TT or the TT as a whole?
It's a TT in its current state. So I think they're going to kill the gas-powered TT and supposedly bring it back as an EV or something in a few years. But the way we know it now is pretty much dead.
Right. So this generation is going to die. It'll probably be in limbo. And then we'll see what they come back with. And also just announced was the diesel version of the Nissan Titan. So Nissan's big truck, they're going to stop selling a diesel version of it, which I think is not a good sign for the Titan, because if you're taking on the domestic full-size truck makers, you want to have as many variants as possible. You want to have as many options. And taking powertrains off the table is not generally considered
We've reported on that it might get a V6, not a V6 diesel, just a gas-powered V6 at the bottom of the range. It's a very sketchy rumor, I'll admit, but so the diesel is going, but there might be some sort of engine to replace it. It's not entirely clear yet.
I can see that as a smart move because it would probably bring the base price down. And I think the only way Toyota and Nissan can compete with the domestics is on price. If they can offer cheaper trucks, then they can get a few sales. But I think Nissan is finding out when you start pricing your truck on the same level as the Ford, the GM trucks, and the Rams, they just can't compete on features and on capability and stuff like that. So.
And one more model to add, the Audi A3 Cabriolet. I am actually working on the story right now. Car and Driver has announced it. I've reached out to Audi just to double check and confirm that, but it looks like the drop top A3 is going away.
Can I be honest? I've never seen a drop top A3 on the road.
I don't think I have either.
I forgot they even existed.
Yeah, so I guess we won't miss that one. All right. So now that we've got the spread before us of all the cars that are being killed this year, we have already taken the time before the podcast to make our list of which vehicles on this list that we would choose to save from the crusher. Now, for every vehicle we choose to save, though, we got to throw another vehicle under the bus. So we're going to go around the room and do these kind of one at a time, save one and kill one. Chris, let's start with you. What's the first car you're going to save and what are you going to sacrifice for it?
So I think Ford, also you'll notice for my first couple picks, there's kind of a theme going on. I'll just tease that now. I think Ford should keep the Fiesta around. And in order to keep it around, I think the mini hardtop three door, or as most people call it, the Mini Cooper, I think it needs to go.
Really? That's like the iconic Cooper.
Well, okay, first off, I own a 2006 Mini Cooper, and I have since October 31st, 2005, I took delivery of it. It's still in the garage. I love my car. But now that BMW is moving more and more to having a front-wheel drive architecture for their lowest, for the kind of their entry-level models, kind of the way Mercedes-Benz has been moving, I kind of think it makes the Mini brand superfluous.
Oh, so you're not really killing the Cooper. You're killing.
I could see the argument for killing the Mini brand, but that's a conversation for another day. I think just the base three door, especially with the new one series going front wheel drive, I don't think that there's an argument for it. I think it could go, especially since the Fiesta is such a nice little hatchback. It's been updated for Europe already. There's already, you know, it's a nice looking car. And arguably the one in Europe is even nicer looking than the current one. So I think it should stick around. But Jeff?
Well, my first one is the Alfa Romeo 4C, which I know it's staying around as a convertible, but I love that car. It's super underrated. I think that is one of the most underrated sports cars right now.
You know what I would do? I would keep the coupe and ditch the convertible. I would just do it backwards. Like, I'm not a convertible fan, so I don't know why would you ever keep the drop top version of a car and kill the coupe?
I don't understand that either, and it's definitely the worst of the two, especially since that car is so loud. I mean, having the top down doesn't really help. But I decided if I'm going to keep the 4C, I have to kill something off in that segment or that's relatively, you know, competitive. So I'm going to go with the BMW i8 because why does that car exist?
I'm actually a fan of the i8. Like, I can say when I've driven it, I've thoroughly enjoyed myself. However, like, convincing myself, like, is there a situation where I win the lottery and I pay someone money for a BMW i8? I can't imagine it. But if somebody hands me one, I actually do enjoy it. But man, is that the hardest car to get in and out of? It is. It is. So hard.
It's just like that when it came out, it was super futuristic looking. I mean, it's still futuristic looking, but it was more revolutionary when it came out. And now we're kind of just letting it slowly just linger without, I mean, they introduced the Roadster, which is kind of cool, but other than that,
I've never seen one of those on the road either.
But. Yeah, it's just the
in Miami, they're like rats.
Oh yeah, I see the i8 all the
north
time.
Then. Oh yeah, they're all over Miami.
Yeah, so i8 has got to go, and the 4C. Everyone needs to go buy a 4C. That's my advice.
Honestly, I've never driven one, and now you guys are giving me two completely opposite takes on it. So
though, I guess I should be completely honest. I've driven the 4C four times. And I have never had one that wasn't broken to some extent. So
I believe that.
Well, here's the thing. I think the 4C, because they started in like the 70s, right?
They are expensive for how small.
They're not a
No, but it's like a Lotus. Like Lotuses are like that too, where they're insanely expensive.
But that was my argument, is that if you look at them on the used market, they're depreciating pretty quickly. And for, you know, one, I think they're kind of still hovering in like the 40s-ish, even high 40s now. But once they drop, you know, if it's a, if it, you could buy one for 28, that's a whole different thing. That could be a fun car for that kind of price.
You know, before we get to mine, I want to go back to yours, Chris, for a second. And I do echo that. I really like the Fiesta. I actually almost bought a five-door Fiesta hatchback titanium, which was like, you know, the highest trim level. And it's just a really fun car to drive. And it came with, it was like under $20,000 new, which was, this was back in 2014. With Mini though, I really want to see Mini come out with a production version of the Rocket Man concept, which is like a sub three-door Mini car. Like it kind of goes back to the roots of Mini with a really small car, like a smart 4.2 sized car. I would love to see that, because all, you know, just with Mini's return in the modern era, they have just kept getting bigger and heavier, and I just want to see that return to its roots before the brand goes away. I don't think the brand's going away, but
and they're expensive too. I mean, the Countryman is kind of cool, but for what you're paying for that, you might as well just get a BMW at that point.
True. Although I like the Clubman. The Clubman's my jam, and BMW doesn't really make a similar car to that. But all right, let me get into my first one. Speaking of the 4.2, I'm gonna pick the 4.2. I feel like you guys are snickering at me maybe for picking this car.
My brow is furrowed, that's for sure.
All right, I'll take that. That's a nice way of putting it. I love weird cars, and I love when automakers try to make business models out of them, and certainly Daimler tried to with Smart in the US. Obviously, they sell a bunch of these in Europe and other places, and in the US, it's always been hampered by the fact that gas prices are cheap, SUVs are popular, but man, this is a rear-engined, rear-wheel drive, impossibly small car. It did improve with the second generation, and the electric version, which is actually all they're selling at the moment in the US, is not that bad. It's like pretty fun to drive. It's not a huge range. It's under 100 miles still, but I don't know. I just feel like I wanted to see it keep going. I wanted to see what it would do next, and I think the US market is better for it to have something at this very, very small end, this really kind of like urban vehicle. And I actually do see to this day 4.2s everywhere. Honestly, not as many of the second generations as the first generations. I think there was like a popularity when it first came out that kind of died off. But I don't know. I think we were better off for having it, and I'm a little sad to see it go. Something has to be sacrificed. I am going to sacrifice, in order to bring the 4.2 back, I would sacrifice the Nissan Maxima. This is a vehicle that for ages has had no point, because the Nissan Altima, which sells about 5 to 10 times more units than the Maxima does, is actually bigger than the Maxima. I mean, it was originally that the Altima was like the compact car and the Maxima was like the midsize.
Well, the Sentra was the compact and then Altima, and then
that. Okay, yeah, I'll give. Maxima. Okay, you're right. So it was Sentra, Altima, Maxima, and they were clearly delineated in size in the day. But then, for whatever reason, Nissan put the Altima on a growth spurt, and the Altima, I believe, is technically rated as a full size car by the EPA according to passenger volume, and its passenger volume is bigger than that of the Maxima.
It's actually a little longer lengthwise than the Maxima.
Yeah, it's crazy, and also like, the Maxima, it's oddly styled. I don't know. Maybe you guys like the styling, but I would
see. I love the styling of the Maxima personally.
What would you do? If you were Nissan, would you keep the Altima, which sells, you know, 25,000 units, and get rid of the Maxima, or would you keep the Maxima and try to make the Maxima your you know, big sedan? I just think the Altima already has the foothold in the sales.
Right. I think that's the argument. I think the Maxima ship has kind of sailed. It was a fantastic, you know, it had the whole four-door sports car branding back in the day, but just the last several generations have kind of languished a lot. And I agree that maybe kill the Maxima and let the Altima bloom.
Yeah, I mean, it's competing and with like the Impala and the Avalon. And like, I mean, these are not high volume segments. And yeah, they're, like I said, they're just, when your supposed mid-size car is bigger than your full-size car, then, you know, one of them doesn't need to be built anymore. All right, swing back around to you, Chris. What's your next one?
This is more of a naming thing. I prefer the ATS name to the CT4, and I would keep ATS around over CT4. So maybe it's not so much keeping the vehicle around as keeping the name around, but to me, the ATS, CTS, XTS, or however you want to do it, naming convention, I prefer it over CT4, CT5, etc. So I would keep ATS around, personally.
In my opinion, I think both naming conventions are terrible because they're both alphanumeric names. They're, you know, just call a car, give a car a name.
I mean, in essence, I agree with that, but I know the argument always goes to when you sell them in foreign markets, the name doesn't mean anything and blah, blah, blah. But maybe I just got used to CTS, it's, you know, STS, blah, 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 for so long that I'm just used to that. But I like the ATS name. I actually like the vehicle. The coupe especially is a fairly attractive car, in my opinion. But going back to what I would kill, and this goes back to the theme of I can't stand retro-styled cars anymore. I think that trend had its day when it was the Mini and the Mustang and the new Beetle and stuff like that. But now it just drives me up the wall. So I think the Fiat 500 has to die.
There are problems with it. I wish they would have developed it more.
Yeah, that's the problem with it, is that it's too old and it's not competitive.
What competes directly with a tiny three-door Fiat 500 these days? I mean, we used to say the Smart 4.2 did. But that's certainly not the case anymore. Honestly, I think this is kind of the same pit that the other small car brands have fallen into, where we're just in an age of cheap fuel, cheap financing. So SUVs are flying out the door, and anything small, anything fuel efficient has a hard time of, you know, generating interest. I think the fact that the Fiat 500 was kind of a retro thing, and it did have really, I'm going to say cute styling, but what I really mean is that it at least it at least created a reaction in people, like an emotional reaction. Like there are tons of versions of the Fiat 500 I love. I love the 500C. That's a great way they do the convertible top where it slides down in the back, but there's still like the frame. I love the Abarth. You know, the retro thing is done, but
I guess my issue is that when you go with retro styling is that it, and when you try to update retro styling, it ages incredibly quickly because people look at it and it looks kind of old immediately. And in my opinion, you have to kind of be ready to iterate on it quickly.
Okay, remember that thought, because when we come back around to me, one of my picks is going to be the exception to that rule.
Okay. I can't wait to see it.
All right. Let's move on to your second one, Jeff.
So I'm going to save the Chevy Equinox diesel. I know the Equinox still exists as the gas-powered version, but I mean, that's whatever. Something about the diesel, when I drove the diesel, it would just felt so satisfying. I mean, there was a lot of torque, it was super efficient, and the Equinox, you know, is still a pretty good SUV. So I think the addition of that diesel engine really helped that car. I think, though, in order to keep the diesel alive, you sort of need to kill something similar in that segment, again, like my first pick. So I'm going to pick the Jeep Compass because I don't really know why that even is a thing.
I would have argued before they had redone the Jeep Compass, you could throw it out the door and nobody would care.
Right.
But the redesigned version, I think, is a pretty decent subcompact. Well, is it a subcompact?
Because well, that's the thing. So that's the problem.
It gets really crowded.
You have the Renegade and you have the Cherokee. And the Cherokee's not huge. And the Compass isn't much smaller than that. I think they're kind of overlapping too much between the Compass and the Cherokee. And I don't think there are enough redeeming qualities of the Compass to sort of warrant not buying a Cherokee. So that SUV doesn't really make sense to me. And, you know, by this game's rules, if I have to keep something I love to... if I have to get rid of something to keep something I love, the compass has got to go.
Yeah, you know what? I think you're right, because when they brought out the compass, they also redesigned the front end of the Cherokee above it so that their front ends look identical. Like, they almost have the exact, like, they even look similar when you see them on the road now, which is a shame. I mean, do you guys remember when the Spy Shots came out of the redesigned Cherokee and people were like, that's the ugliest thing ever? And that design that of the Cherokee, and I want to call it first gen, but, like, you know, the first generation of the new Cherokee, that grew on me so much over the years, and I thought it looked great, especially when it was butched up in the Trailhawk edition and all that. So I actually don't like that they made the front end of the Cherokee more normal, but by doing so, they made it look just like the Compass, and now those two vehicles just kind of fight with each other. And the Renegade actually has its own cool little styling edge going on. So I would pick, yeah, you're right, I would keep that instead of the Compass. So
yeah, I think the Compass would be more forgivable if it looked different. I mean, like you said, the Compass and the Cherokee, they look the same now, so I don't really see the point of having both.
Yeah, and with the diesel, with the Equinox diesel, I completely agree with what you said about it. Whenever I drive, you know, of course I've driven diesel trucks before, and that's a whole other thing, but when I'm driving like a passenger car with a diesel engine, there's just the driving experience is so nice, because it just feels like there's wells of power. Not that the power comes on like fast and hard, like a, you know, like a sports car or something. It's just, you dip into the accelerator and it just says, okay, I'll do it. I'm going to get there. And it's just like a quiet, unrushed well of power. And then you look down and you're like 50 miles per gallon average. You're like, what the hell? It's such a cool driving experience. So I'm a little sad that diesel passenger cars are really, really being punished for the diesel gate and all of the law breaking that went on with that, especially because GM didn't do any of that law breaking. So, but they're definitely suffering because of it. All right. So I guess I'm up next. So what I want to save is, I think, a pretty obvious one. The Volkswagen Beetle. I don't want to see this storied nameplate end. And as a matter of fact, I think it's actually at a high watermark. When they brought the new Beetle back, you know, that was dripping in kind of retroism. That leaned into it, right? Into the cutesy nature of the Beetle. When they redesigned it for the second time, I thought one interesting thing that the designers did that I heard them talk about was they didn't redesign the new Beetle. They designed another Beetle based off the original. So it wasn't that they were creating the second generation of the new Beetle. It was that they were doing a second attempt, an altogether different attempt at redesigning the original Beetle. And I think the second generation one is an amazing design. I think they did some fun stuff with it, with good special editions. The Dune was pretty cool, although it would have been fun if they had done some more mechanical stuff to it.
I wish that thing had been all-wheel drive. That's the one thing, you know, if they had used, you know, the Volkswagen's 2-liter turbo with all-wheel drive in that car, it would have been so much more amazing than it was.
Yeah. I wish they had just leaned into it more, like even a couple more inches of ground clearance, larger wheels and tires.
Even that.
Yeah, all that stuff. Maybe spare tire on the back, you know, something like that. But yeah, I mean, and this is one of the most famous, iconic cars of all time. So to see it end its run and kind of in a whimper is not, I don't like seeing it. However, what I would choose to sacrifice, I would be happy to take a baseball bat too. And I'm going to cheat a little. I'm going to pick three cars, because I'm not just killing a car. I'm killing a kind of car. I'm picking the Honda Clarity fuel cell, the Hyundai Tucson fuel cell, and the Toyota Mirai. I think hydrogen fuel cell cars are dumb. You guys remember the movie Mean Girls, when that girl was trying to make the word fetch happen? It's not happening. Hydrogen cars are not happening. So these companies should just stop. The train has already left the station for full-on electric vehicles. Charging infrastructure is already being built for that. In addition to, you know, the actual electric grid that everyone has pumped into their house to recharge electric vehicles, you know, I could count the number of hydrogen refueling stations outside of California on one hand, probably. They're just not going to happen. Nobody cares. You know, I feel like they don't even really sell these to the general public. It's like they always come with conditions of like, you got to live near a hydrogen fueling station and you can only lease it and you got to give it back and whatever. These guys can, it's not happening. And I don't even want to see it happen. Like, I would rather the development of battery electric vehicles continue because, you know, if we can switch the grid over to cleaner sources of energy, like renewables, that's much better. We don't have to go, you know, bottling hydrogen up.
Oh God, I have so many things to say. has the Beetle ever been a good car?
Oh, the second gen Beetle or
any Beetle ever?
Oh,
like,
God,
a
yes.
Good car.
Yes, come on.
Really? I mean, the original Beetle was a cheap car. It was an affordable car.
But that's what makes it good. I mean, it all depends on how you define good.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I mean, the current Beetle even is, I don't know. Why would I ever buy that over anything else outside of styling? Like, it's not good.
But that's a big reason. Like, if you, again, all car purchases, I think, have a huge emotional element to them.
Right.
And the Beetle has always kind of had an edge in that respect where people just fall in love with it.
But then you get in it and you drive it and you realize that you bought it just because of styling, because nothing else is redeemable. And I know I'm being harsh on the Beetle.
That's way too harsh. I wouldn't say that they're not redeemable. I would say you'd get in a Beetle and you'd realize, oh, this is a pretty normal car, except for how it looks.
Yeah, okay. All right, fair. I mean, the Beetle just, I mean, to Chris's point on retro styling, that's another one of those cars that's like, you got to let it die. You got to do something different, because retro styling to me just doesn't work at all anymore.
Yeah, I could see a Beetle coming back under Volkswagen's ID electric range.
Yes.
Maybe not, you know, maybe a retro futuristic Beetle. Keep the hatchback, keep kind of that stuff. You could actually, since it's electric, you could do rear engine, rear wheel drive pretty easily, like the original.
I don't have this. I don't have the same reaction to you guys that you guys do to the retro styling. I think it depends on a case by case basis. I think some retro styling leans way too heavily on that nostalgia factor, and I think other ones are just done really well and can continue. And like I said, I think Volkswagen did the smart thing by not trying to redesign the new Beetle. They just made a new version of the old Beetle again. So I think if it's done well, it can always be gone back to. And we talk about this all the time, because a lot of dealerships around the country are making retro versions of vehicles because the automakers won't. We're seeing like throwback versions of Chevy trucks and Ford trucks, and companies are making modern versions of the GMC Cyclone. And, you know, there always seems to be a demand for stuff like that. And then
those
just depends on
retro
execution.
Those aren't retro in quite the same way, though. I almost think of those as the way sneaker companies do colorways in retro ways, where they're taking the modern truck but applying the old color schemes and touches onto them. Like, I know the 1G people, or I think it's the Gladiator people wood panel decals essentially on the side to make it look like, you know, some of the older Jeeps, or the one Ford with the blue and white that the dealer's doing. Those are thoroughly modern vehicles that look totally modern. They just have a retro color scheme.
Yeah, but don't you think that's pulling the same nostalgic string? And the only reason the dealers are doing it that way is because that's all they're capable of doing. Like, a dealer can't redesign a vehicle or launch a vehicle. All they can do is add to vehicles to add those nostalgic elements. But I think they're doing that, and there's a market for it, because it's pulling on that same nostalgic string of people remember vehicles when they were younger. And, you know, when you remind them of that, it again makes an emotional attachment to a vehicle, gets them to want to buy it.
You know what I will say, though, John? I mean, to all the retro, you know, modern trucks and SUVs that you mentioned are exactly that. There are no cars that manufacturers or that dealerships are doing that to. I mean, I'm sure there's a few, but I think the retro car design thing has worn out, and I think retro trucks and SUVs are starting to sort of make a comeback. Because even if you look at like the Telluride or the Rivian, like those are very boxy, like old school kind of designs, and I think that is going to be more popular coming up. And even Volkswagen with the bus, that's going to be, yeah. I think it's going to be a hit.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a really good observation. You're right. It seems like all of the current wave of nostalgia has kind of been applied to trucks more than cars. Any disagreements with killing all hydrogen fuel cell vehicles?
Yes. I am a very pro hydrogen fuel cell person, and I
interesting. Do tell.
I don't really know why. I think
good way to start.
You know, I think what it is the convenience factor. Because
there is no convenience factor.
Well, there is theoretically, right? So if you have a hydrogen fuel cell station on every corner, like you do a gas station, why would you not buy hydrogen fuel cell, right? The problem
is, sure, but that's not true, and it would take an act of God to get us there, or 30 years and like $1 trillion.
Would it though? I mean, I understand that the technology for hydrogen fuel cell is crazy complex, and I'm not even going to pretend to know what I'm talking about, but someone with money and who's smart can figure it out, right? I mean, if Elon Musk can do all this stuff with Tesla and all the charging infrastructure, someone could theoretically do the same thing with fuel cells, right?
I mean, I guess, but there's got to be a reason nobody is. And I would say the reason is because the promise and potential of battery powered cars is more. I mean, there are right now Tesla superchargers that can add 75 miles of range in 5 minutes. There are chargers that are charging at the rate of like 1,000 miles, adding 1,000 miles in an hour. So the charge rates are going up quickly as well. Like I said, it's way easier to build out an EV charging infrastructure than a hydrogen refueling infrastructure. So I guess what I'm saying is what you're saying might be true if there were a hydrogen refueling station on every corner, but the logistics of that happening are the challenges are so great. I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Well, you know what it is. It's the gas companies, and I'm not going to get all political here, but theoretically, if the gas companies were like, you know what, we're going to stop digging for oil and we're going to invest all in fuel cell technology. Every Shell is going to be a fuel cell station. They could do it. I mean,
but still, every house is going to have an electrical outlet.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, charging over an electrical outlet still takes, 8 to 10 hours if you have a good one. I think the convenience factor is what sells me on hydrogen fuel cell over EVs right now.
You guys know my wife just got a Tesla Model 3. We got a 240-volt outlet put in our garage. She charges it maybe once a week because it has a 315-mile range. There's no downside to it at all,
right,
in terms of inconvenience. There's no inconvenience to it all. It's actually very convenient.
Well, I'm not down on EVs either. I think it's great, and I think I would love to buy one. But for me, so I just drove to Orlando last week. And theoretically, if I were to buy a Model 3, right, the range of the Model 3 is, even the long range one is what, 320, 330?
I would have. Well, 315 actually, but let's say, 300 plus.
So I would have to stop around halfway and recharge, which would, without a fast charger, would take like half an hour, right? And then I'd have to map out.
Would you be stopping at a Tesla supercharger?
Well, that depends. I'd have to find one on the way there, and I don't think they're... I mean,
I don't know. They're pretty strategically placed for long-range travel, but yeah, you'd have to look.
Yeah. It's just the convenience I still don't think is totally there. I mean, it's coming, but...
Look at it this way. If you were driving a fuel cell vehicle, you could only probably travel only the radius away from your house that you could get back, because there isn't a hydrogen fueling station anywhere, that you're going to find out there.
Yeah, it's the same point I was going to make.
Let me say another reason why fuel cells haven't caught on and should die. Let's look at these cars and you tell me what level of excitement or passion they instill in you. The Honda Clarity, the Hyundai Tucson, the Toyota Mirai. These are the biggest snooze fest vehicles that one could build a new technology on. And I think whatever you think about Tesla, one thing they got right was they made exciting vehicles. They started with, you know, the Roadster. And even though you might not think a full-size sedan or, you know, like a mid-size sedan, like a Model 3 is exciting on the face of it, they made sure that they were the fastest cars around, and that makes them exciting. But none of the fuel cell vehicles that have ever been sold have instilled any passion or excitement in anybody, which, you know, helps push the technology along if people are interested in the vehicle itself.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Nexo is kind of cool, but...
Oh, I forgot about the Nexo.
Yeah, because they don't sell any.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's kind of proving my point. But even isn't the Nexo just based on Kona? Yeah, it's the Kona. So it's just the Kona.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's keep the train moving. I think this is our last go around the table. Chris, what's your last save? What's your last kill?
So it's actually really interesting we started this conversation because this is going to piggyback nicely on top of it. So the first part, I'm going to keep the Volkswagen Touareg, because to me it is far more attractive than the Atlas or the Tiguan. I kind of, from a Volkswagen business perspective, I understand, because they have so many other crossovers in that kind of luxury space, from Audi or Porsche, or if you really go up in price, Bentley, that I can understand why you would axe the Touareg. But from an aesthetic perspective, I think it's way better looking than the vehicles that are replacing it.
It's very handsome. And there have been some really cool engines for the Touareg throughout its lifespan. It had a diesel, right?
V10 diesel,
V10 diesel. Oh, yeah. Man, that would be such a great used car get.
But to piggyback on what we were talking about, in order to keep the Touareg, I would kill the Toyota Prius.
Ooh.
And here's why. I think the time for a vehicle that's dedicated on a hybrid powertrain is over. I think we are to the point where a hybrid is not novel anymore, and you can put a hybrid powertrain in any vehicle you want, and it's fine, and it's no longer special, and at that point, you no longer need the Prius. You can make a Camry hybrid, and no one's going to bat an eye at
it. I think Toyota agrees with you, because they just launched the Corolla hybrid, which basically
Which is like the same tech as the Prius.
Tech as the Prius, and like 1 mile per gallon, you know, fewer, which is like nothing in the grand scheme of things. So I agree with you. Like, being a hybrid isn't anything special, and I don't think the Prius has as large a lead over other cars in terms of fuel economy that it once had. But here's where Toyota screwed up. They were king of the hybrid hill with the Prius. Right. Like, the Prius outsold everything.
Especially the second gen. The first gen kind of proved that the tech worked, and then the second gen was like, that's the one that like Leonardo DiCaprio was buying and stuff like that.
Right, exactly. But what they didn't do was take the next step and start immediately, you know, planning long-term for electric vehicles. As a matter of fact, Toyota could be, you can find quotes of them saying that electric vehicles aren't going to happen, and they were putting all their chips on fuel cells. Which is why we have the Mirai. And only recently have they haven't admitted their mistake, but they've changed their plans and have announced, you know, their future plans for, like, you know, a full electric lineup, like every other company is announcing. So they made a major misstep, and I think it kind of left the Prius out high and dry, because that could have transitioned nicely into a full battery powered lineup, and the Prius could have kept growing as a brand. But instead, it kind of just kept getting, you know, I mean, look, it stayed the most fuel efficient vehicle in the US for a very long time.
Oh, and sure. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the Prius as a vehicle. I just think the time has come where you don't need a dedicated hybrid vehicle. You can just put that powertrain in a RAV4 or a Camry or a Corolla, and it's fine. And you don't need to sell people on, oh, this is a Prius.
Yeah, I think the only shame is that I think they, at one point in time, had so much like brand equity in Prius. Yep. And I think a lot of it has been kind of wasted away because they didn't kind of capitalize on it and make the right business decisions to carry that through to batteries or something like that. All right, Jeff, what's your last pick?
I'm going to echo Chris and say, or Chris's earlier pick, and say that the Ford Fiesta needs to stick around.
Wow, this is the only one that's gotten two votes so far.
Yeah, so I thought about the Focus, and the new Focus for Europe is super nice. But it kind of doesn't make sense because the Echo Sport, people are going to buy that like 10 times over the Focus, even though it's...
I don't know that sales actually bear that out, but okay.
That's true. But theoretically, right, people want subcompact SUVs over hatchbacks. But I think the Fiesta is still small enough to make sense, right? You don't have a, an SUV that small. I mean, there's it's still a jump from the Fiesta to the EcoSport. So I think the Fiesta would still make sense. But in order to do that, I think you would need to kill off one of its competitors, which would be the Honda Fit.
Whoa.
I agree with you're half right. Let's keep the Fiesta, but let's keep the Fit too.
I mean, the Fit has generally been considered like the standard for, I mean, what size class? Subcompact hatchbacks?
Yeah.
You know, with this little magic rear seat that flips up and it's very versatile. Wow, that's bold. That's bold.
Yeah, but that car has flown under the radar for too long. Like, when are they going to totally redo it? It's just been sitting forever. I mean, it feels like it. I don't know when the last actual, like, full makeover or full update was.
Well, it's a very global vehicle. They sell it all over the world. I think it's called the Jazz in other markets. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's definitely not going away altogether because it's a huge, probably a sales juggernaut globally.
Can we take a moment to say that there should be a Fit SI to compete against the Fiesta ST?
Yeah, definitely.
That would be good.
That would be awesome. I mean, honestly, I thought that's why you guys wanted to bring the Fiesta back was to get the Fiesta ST back. Neither of you mentioned it.
That is a big part of it because the Fiesta ST was very good. I mean, it's still, you can get those reused for really cheap and they're awesome cars. But just the Fiesta as a whole makes sense. If you want something that's affordable and easy to live with and you don't want a crossover necessarily, I think the Fiesta is just a good car.
I guess the reason I'm surprised is because the Fit, I think, is more versatile than the Fiesta. Like, it's an equally small car, but the interior is much larger and can be configured in more ways. Like, it's like when you get that small of a car, you need something that can do a lot of things well. And the Fit's very good at that, or I think the Fiesta is a little bit more hampered by its packaging and things like that. I can tell you the current Fit appears to have been around since 2013. So yeah, it's long in the tooth for sure. For sure. All right, that a controversial pick, but we'll let it stand. Let me throw out my last one. What I would like to see continued to be built, my last choice, is the Chevy Cruze. And this is less because I think it's a great product, although I think it was a fine product. But, and Chris, maybe you feel this way too. Chris and I both live in Ohio. I live not that far away from the Lordstown plant where it's built. And I just have to say, like, look, whoever you are listening to this podcast, I don't know where you live, but if you live within the vicinity of an automotive plant, like you just... It's not that you feel the reverberations when a plant closes, but like when, you know, I mean, I live in Cleveland and the local news talks about Lordstown all the time. I mean, these are a lot of people that are losing their jobs. They built a good car, they built it well, and then this thing is suddenly happening to them. So, you know, I actually loved the first gen Cruze. I thought that was actually better than the second gen. There was a speaking of like Prius competitors, there was a high fuel efficiency version of the first generation Cruze, and it was gas powered. It was not diesel, but it was just like it had some aerodynamic tweaks. It had a super efficient engine and a transmission, and it was like it was the best version of the Cruze they ever made. It was so smooth. Really nice power and got crazy good fuel mileage for a gas powered vehicle. When they did the redesign, I don't know, it felt like more of the same, I guess. It didn't feel like it really improved in any significant way. And then they had the Cruze hatchback, which was not a, it was neither a good hatchback nor a good business decision. It really, I mean, the back hatch was so raked that it hardly had any extra cargo capacity compared to the sedan. And then they also had the Cruise diesel, which, you know, like we were talking about diesel passenger cars before, you know, I thought, you know, I think it was victim of the Dieselgate and some of that and the rise in popularity of hybrids. But ultimately there's this great plant sitting over in Lordstown that made, great cars for a really long time. And now they're holding out hope that this company called Workhorse that makes electric trucks is gonna buy it from GM and put some of these people back to work. But ultimately I just, you know, I'm not like a nationalist who wants to see, you know, American plants making cars at all costs, because then we would all be paying $10,000 extra per car. But this was a really good plant. And it definitely, I thought, deserved to find a solution somewhere or find a really good buyer to take it over. And it's still waiting for that. All right, to put something out of its misery that I think should be sacrificed in order to get the Cruise back, I'm going to pick the Volkswagen Passat. And the reason I'm picking the Passat, even though I generally think the Passat is good, but Volkswagen also sells the Arteon, which is like a more expensive, prettier, better handling version of the Passat. I would rather Volkswagen just get rid of the Passat, figure out how to make less expensive versions of the Arteon, and then just have the Arteon be its midsize slash full size car. The Passat is perhaps one of the most boring looking cars ever made. It is just, you look at it and the only word that pops into your head is car. Like
it's also a nonsensical car in its own way, given the fact that the American version and the European version are completely different. And from what our European colleagues tell me, the European one is far and away better. So Yeah,
the only thing the American version of the Passat has ever had going for it is it is physically huge. It has perhaps the greatest amount of interior space and rear legroom. So, you know, whenever anybody would ask me about the Passat and whether it's a good car to buy, that's the only thing I could say about it was it's got a really big backseat. Now, if you look at the Arteon, oh, that's a gorgeous looking car. It's I'm trying to think really quickly off the top of my head. Is there any prettier Volkswagen on sale in the U.S.? And I don't think so. It's got to be the Arteon. So I think they've got it, you know, much like Nissan has the Maxima and the Altima, and one of them can go. I think Volkswagen has the Passat and the Arteon, and one of them can go. And I would pick the Arteon to stay.
That makes sense. I mean, to your point earlier about the Cruise, a lot like the Equinox, the diesel hatchback was my favorite Cruise. And it definitely wasn't a good hatchback by, you know, hatchback standards. But it was a great little car. I mean, that was a fun car to drive.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think, you know, I half want to save the Cruise because it was a good car, but I also want to half save it because, you know, the plant is near me and, right. And I hear these stories all the time. But it was definitely a good car. But, you know, I mean, just like Ford, all of these small cars are getting axed in favor of small SUVs. And that's, you know, the reality we live in today until the next oil crisis comes or what. But yeah, I don't think the Cruise deserves to go. And I'm happy to sacrifice the Passat to keep it around. If only we had the power to do any of this, which we don't. But that's what makes thought experiments so fun. All right. Well, we'd love to hear what all of you have to think about our decisions on what to keep and what to kill. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at MotorOneCom. And of course, the discussion will continue there. And of course, on our website, MotorOne.com, we talk about this stuff in the comments all the time. So join us there. Coming up, we're going to find out what we've been driving this week. But before the break, I just want to remind everyone, if you're listening to this online, you can also get our show on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So please hit subscribe so you get the next episode. Welcome back. During this part of the show, we talk about what cars we're driving this week. And today I'm going to start with you, Jeff. What are you driving this week?
So I was in Nashville towards the tail end of last week and driving the Nissan Versa, the brand new for 2020 Nissan Versa.
So speaking of small cars, this one is happens to still be around. But this is, I mean, this is the car that was the cheapest car in America for a while. I don't think it is anymore, though, right?
Yeah, it was. It's $14,370 now, which is the makes it the second cheapest car in America, just behind the Spark LS. But I mean, $14,000 for what you get is, it's kind of ridiculous that you can get automatic emergency braking, rear automatic emergency braking, you know, a touchscreen, a digital instrument cluster for $14,000 on the Versa.
Yeah, talk about the trickle down of technology, and particularly safety technology, from, you know, like luxury vehicles and much more expensive cars. I mean, that is insane that you get that you're going to get active safety systems like automatic emergency braking on a sub $15,000 new car. Honestly, like if I had a kid who is just starting to drive or going off to college, like, yeah, I mean, I would be totally attracted to that. For, you know, you're getting a warranty for one, because it's a new car, you're getting these safety features that you'd pay a lot of extra for a few years ago, and yeah, and it's otherwise, you know, and good infotainment system. So did it drive well?
It drove fine. I mean, it drives like a Versa. It's totally acceptable. I mean, there's nothing super inoffensive about it. I mean, it's kind of slow. I think the engine, it's the same engine from the previous Versa, so there's really no mechanical updating. I think it's a little more powerful, and they tweaked it a little bit. So 122 horsepower, 114 pound-feet of torque, which is, it's totally fine. I mean, I think the only issue that I really had was the CVT was super loud. I mean, even for CVT, just based on how good CVTs have gotten these days, it shouldn't be as loud as it was. But other than that, I mean, it's a totally fine car to toss around. There's nothing offensive about it. And between this and the Kicks, I can't really find a reason to recommend anything else for like young buyers, like you said, John, because standard safety, automatic emergency braking, and rear automatic emergency braking in the Versa, and then, you know, Apple CarPlay, touchscreen. It's just, it's hard to find a car that's better at this price.
You know, it's funny because I just finished a book about the Yugo, which of course used to be the cheapest car sold in America in the late 80s at $39.95, and was basically a death trap and had no features at all. And now we're talking about a car that sure is three to four times the price. But, you know, now the cheapest car in America comes with all these standard features and infotainment and to talk about safety, I mean, are legitimately safe cars. Man, what a difference in 30 years from the days of Yugo to the days of the Versa and the Nissan Note.
Yeah, and we just had a Mirage, Mitsubishi Mirage, I don't know, last week, 2 weeks ago.
How is that not the cheapest car in the U.S.?
It's not. That's what's crazy, because the Mirage is so bad. You get a metal key, you get a terrible, you know, all the buttons and knobs are super cheap, stuff is falling out. Meanwhile, you have the Versa that's, you know, a few thousand cheaper, maybe a few hundred cheaper, like base model than the Mirage. And it's really, like, nice. It's really well finished, and it looks surprisingly good. I didn't think I was going to like the way it looked in person, but it looks like a shrunken Altima. It's a little stubby because just that class, you can't really avoid
it. Proportions, yeah.
Yeah, but it's a good-looking car.
The Mirage is really the Yugo of our time.
Yes.
How much did you say the Yugo started at when it was new?
$39.95.
Whoa. So I just, out of curiosity, I plugged it in 1989, January 1989, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, $39.95 today is $8,449.
Yeah, so imagine how stripped a new car today would have to be to match
$8,500 essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, they were being built by communists in what country was it?
Yugoslavia, right? Isn't that why it was
Yugo?
Oh
yeah, Yugoslavia.
Zastava?
Well, okay. The Yugo does not come from the name Yugoslavia. I'll have to look it up. The book talked about it, but people think it's called Yugo because of the name of the country, and it's not. It's actually from something else. But unfortunately, I can't finish the cool anecdote with the actual answer because I don't remember. But I'll look it up and maybe bring it to next week's podcast. All right. So, Chris, what have you been driving this past week?
So last Monday, I got a direct message on our Slack channel from my coworker, Chris Smith, who I'm sure you're also familiar with if you've been reading Motor One. And he asked me if I owned an Xbox One X, and I didn't. And he had just bought an Xbox One X, which is the top of the line, and was looking to move his S, which is kind of the middle grade, and asked me if I wanted it. So a PayPal transaction later, and last Friday, I have a Xbox One, and so I have been playing Forza Horizon 4.
Ah, how do you like it?
I love it. It's a ton of fun. It's great. It runs great on that version of the console. The car I've mostly been using is the modern Acura NSX with a little bit of a Lancia 037 Stradale mixed in as well. It's a super fun game.
Now, are you okay? Because I got very recently, I got Xbox Game Pass so I could try out Forza Horizon 4.
Yep, I did the same thing for the dollar a month thing. Yeah,
on the recommendation of Chris Smith, as a matter of fact. And I don't know, maybe I'm getting old and I just because I haven't been playing a lot of video games lately. I played it, to be honest, I played it once. I didn't really give it a huge shot, but I'm the kind of gamer with that kind of game who has to follow like the career. So I go wherever they tell me. Like if they say, oh, this guy wants you to race over there, I go drive and race over there. Are you doing that? Or are you just doing the open sandbox? I'm going to go drive around wherever the hell I want.
A little bit of both. So I've done a lot. So I knew from looking online that in order to open up being able to play with other people, when you first get the game, you have to kind of do some of the challenges and stuff like that. So I did as many of those as I needed to do at first. And I've now opened up the ability to play with other people. So Chris messaged me Saturday night and we were going to set up a race and it fell through. But so now I'm doing some challenges, but then also doing some online races and stuff like that.
If you guys race, can you, I think this is easy to do now. Can you set it up on Twitch so we can watch? Cause maybe watching you guys race will convince me to,
I think so. Yeah. We'll have to look into it, but yeah. But so yeah, I've been doing some challenges, but I get a kind of a kick out of the online racing. It's more fun to me to play with real people than it is the AI, just because real people mess up and do dumb things. And so it's not like racing a computer that's always perfect. It's people that just kind of are people. So
yeah. Although when I used to play online, people would just like, you know, go into a corner at 1,000 miles an hour and knock everybody offline.
But see, if you do that in Horizon, it's actually smart that if it predicts that you're going to have a high speed collision, it ghosts your car out. So then you can't hit anybody.
Really?
Yep.
That's smart. And then so basically you just screw yourself.
Yeah, essentially.
I like that. I like that. All right. So, well, it's been fun. Good choice driving for the week.
Can I clarify something really quick? Sorry, I had to look up the Mirage price because it was driving me crazy. The Mirage is a little bit cheaper than the Versa to start by like a few hundred bucks. But the Mirage that we were driving was more expensive than the Versa that I was driving. And it was still totally worse.
Do you remember how much the Mirage was? Because I think you were driving a loaded one.
It was loaded. It was like, such as it is. It was almost 20 grand, I think.
Oh my god,
which is crazy for a Mirage. And the Versa was like 18 or 19, and it was like 10 times better.
Man, so. I wonder what the Mirages are really selling for. You know, when the negotiation is done, they got to be like going for way less than that. All right. So this week I'm driving a Cadillac XT4. Speaking of their silly naming schemes. This is their this is their subcompact luxury crossover. I would say their compact is the XT5. So when I think of this size of luxury SUV, the real small ones, I immediately go to the Volvo XC40, which is, I think, the best in the class. And it's currently one of my favorite vehicles on sale right now. I love the XC40. It's a pleasure to drive. It looks so cool. And it has every Volvo touch I love. And they're doing a lot of good things with interior design and infotainment right now. So the XC4 really had a high bar when I got into it. And this is going to sound like not a compliment, but I mean it as a compliment. My first impression is that the XT4 does not fall all over itself. It is decent. It looks good from the outside. The interior is designed well. Everything works, you know, as it should. And I would say it doesn't drive as well as the XC40. I felt like the XC40 was a little bit more fun to drive, but it's not bad at all. The one thing about driving it is the sight lines are not great because the belt line, you know, the bottom of the windows is very high and the back window is very small. So it definitely gives you that claustrophobic feel like you're sitting in a Camaro or something. Where it really falls down though is price, because I immediately hopped on the configurator and I'm like, all right, let me see how much a similarly equipped XC40 would cost. And it's like $3,000 to $5,000 less. And we're already talking about cars that are actually, I think I have the thing right here. The Cadillac is upper 40s, which is really, you know, that's expensive for a subcompact crossover.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
XC40 was about 44, 45, also expensive, but I just felt like this is a very premium vehicle. And you get that feeling a little less with the XC40. I had heard some negative criticism though of the XC40, and I didn't, my experience so far does not totally match that, but it's not knocking me out of the park either. I think when I do review it and score it, it's probably going to get a pretty average score.
It kind of sounds like you're damning it with faint praise, honestly.
I am. It's hard to give Cadillac praise because it's like every good thing you say is followed by a but these days. So that's the best I can do. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow Jeff on Twitter at NotABoatCaptain. Chris is on Twitter at ChrisBruce1985. And you can follow me at John_M_Neff. I want to thank you guys for being here and talking on the show with me.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And of course, thanks everyone out there for listening. We'll talk to you next week.